Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. In the studio this afternoon to discuss urology is Dr. Paul Pietro of a premier medical group of the Hudson Valley. Dr. Pietro earned his Doctor of Medicine degree from the University of Virginia School of Medicine, was a resident in both general surgery and urologic surgery at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee. He specializes in general urology, including the treatment of kidney stones, surgical kidney cancer management, BPH, and PSA screening. Dr. Pietro, welcome back to the Vox Pop.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
To be part of today's conversation, and somebody's already on the line, give us a call at 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. So, is the PSA still a good test?
How much time do we have?
PSA, for the rest of you, is
prostate-specific antigen.
And the way that we sort of screen for prostate cancer is a lot of people go in and this is part of their regular blood test.
It certainly can be. I think if we really try to distill this pretty quickly, PSA can be a useful screening test for guys who have at least 10 to 15 years life expectancy ahead of them, probably 50s into 60s, and greater risk perhaps in African-American men or guys with a family history of prostate cancer. So there is some benefit to screening so long as we're careful that we don't overtreat. So if you don't overtreat, there's some benefit to screening.
So everybody says the same thing, obviously. You know, don't overtreat.
I hope so.
Don't overtreat, right? And then you get to be Alan and you get to be 72 years old. And they say, okay, well, at your age, we don't want to overtreat. So in some cases, guys like me get to have, you know, cancer. And often the answer is, well, let's just let age take care of it because it takes a long time before you die. And then there are those of us who say, hell with that, I want to be operated on.
Well, you know, I have this conversation many times a week.
Every time.
Yeah. And so the idea is not that we don't care about our guy patients. It's just we're trying to put things into perspective. A lot of prostate cancer is really slow, indolent, smoldering, really not very quick at all. And at that point, the treatment and the side effects may be worse than the benefit they could
sure.
derive. So it's really about trying to keep the balance and trying to keep the perspective.
So can you tell what kind of a prostate cancer it is? In other words, you say some of it is slow, smoking,
yeah,
you know,
right,
all the rest
right.
of it, like on the barbecue. But what if it turns out that you can take a sample and say, oh, wait, this one is a bad one. We have to do something about this.
Yeah, so more recently, we use what's called the Gleason scoring system. That's the grade. And the grade of any kind of cancer tells us how aggressive it's likely to be. Mm-hmm. So a Gleason 6 cancer is generally the low-grade stuff. And then 7 is kind of intermediate. And you can break that down to different subtypes. And then 8, 9, 10 tends to get clumped into the high grade. So if you've got a little bit of low volume of Gleason 6 cancer, you're more likely to be overtreated. So we tend to just follow those. The higher gray stuff we're more likely to treat, intermediate, a little more gray. So we tend to use the Gleason grade to help decide who gets managed, who gets treated, who gets watched.
And how do you come to the Gleason grade?
So that's from a biopsy result. So someone may have had an abnormal prostate exam, someone may have had an abnormal PSA that would have led to a prostate biopsy.
But I read in some report recently that there are those urologists who think we're doing too much biopsy.
Yeah. Well, that is true. I mean, every now and then we get some gentleman who comes in. He's in his late 70s. He's really not looking too healthy at all. And
yeah.
I don't have a crystal ball, but I can pretty much guess that he's not going to live 10, 15 years. And he comes in, they got sent to me for his PSA. Well, that's the guy I shouldn't biopsy. I should tell him, thank you, what else can I help you with, and send him back on his way.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're a surgeon. What other surgical procedures do you regularly perform?
Well, I mean, they're really varied, which is one of the joys of urology, is that it's kidney stones, it's voiding dysfunction, it's cancer type of things. It's
voiding dysfunction, you do Roto-Rooter?
That is still out there, still sort of the gold standard. A lot of guys are able to avoid the transurethral resection of the prostate. They can avoid the Roto-Rooter through medical management. But for some folks, they still end up doing some type of resection of the prostate with a laser or with scraping, taking little slivers. So there are still guys who get to that point, But that's one of the things we do.
Are you retraining, or do you guys retrain in when the newest things come along, like minimally invasive?
A lot of times we pick up as it goes along. So in our own group, you know, there's some of us do more of one type of surgery, and some of the other guys do other things. There's a few of us who really have a subspecialty. I do a lot of laparoscopic and robotic kidney work.
Mm.
So my partners send me a lot of those cases to take care of. So it's not necessary for all nine of us to keep up with every single technique and every single tool.
Yeah, but obviously things are moving along.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, and so, he who hesitates gets left behind.
You know, I always sort of say that you don't want to be the first one to the new technique nor the last. So you want to make sure it's really going to be worth your time.
Let's go to Al in Albany. Okay, Al in Albany, you are on. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a BPH and have been taking Proscar for many years. And I found that it affected me negatively. So I went on testosterone replacement therapy. And my question to you is, can you take testosterone and Proscar together, and do they counteract each other, et cetera?
Okay, before you answer, Al from Albany, excellent question. We need to know some things so that those of us who are out in the audience who have no idea what anybody's talking about is, what's BPH?
So BPH is benign prostatic hyperplasia, and that gets used loosely to describe folks who have voiding symptoms. Probably a better term is lower urinary tract symptoms or voiding symptoms. Guys who have some troubles urinating.
Is that often because of larger prostates?
So part of that is the actual enlargement of the prostate gland. That's the hyperplasia. But part of it is a tone. So some guys, they may not have a large prostate, but they have a lot of symptoms. And that's because the prostate's a little tight. And it doesn't relax.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll treat the size. And that's what Proscar might do.
I see. And now to answer his specific question.
Proscar blocks the conversion of testosterone to its more potent form called dihydrotestosterone, and that mostly happens in the prostate. So in theory, if you took Proscar, you could block the enlargement of the prostate by taking that medication, but then by taking testosterone, you may be boosting testosterone effects elsewhere. So muscle mass, memory, mental acuity, general sense of energy and such. So you may be able to still keep the localized prostate effects and be able to sneak through some of the more general other body effects of the testosterone.
When you were making that list, I was wondering whether when you said, you know, each of those things, was that the testosterone would make it better or worse?
So this is one of my soapbox issues. We just sort of stumbled across. But testosterone certainly does help guys' sort of general mood, and it can help our mental acuity, all those things we went through.
Sure.
So generally getting more of that may be helpful. Unfortunately, I'm always a little suspicious that it gets overused, which is really a different question.
Yeah.
But a lot of guys come in with symptoms of feeling kind of run down, feeling a little tired, feeling a little less sexual, feeling less sharp, and they want testosterone to help that. And, you know, there's a myriad of other causes that'll give you those exact same symptoms.
Yeah, yeah.
So testosterone is not some panacea for just kind of getting older and gaining some weight and getting out of shape.
Some women want their husbands to take anti-testosterone.
Yeah, well, there's those patients as well. but Al, the testosterone may be able to help some of the general symptoms. What side effects of the Proscar did you not like?
Basically, the ones you described. Yeah. Mood, sex drive, the whole thing. And I was tested for my testosterone level, and it was found to be low normal for my age. So I went on the testosterone gel, and there's improvement in all the areas.
Yeah.
I had stopped the Proscar, but now I feel I need to start it up again, and I have started it up in the last few days, actually.
Why? Are you peeing too much, or what's the problem?
Difficulty urinating.
Yeah, and there are other medications as well. I mean, it doesn't have to be Proscar is the only way to treat those voiding symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, there are alpha blockers. There's a whole category of medications called alpha blockers, and there's a slew there. There's older less precise drugs all the way up to more potent, really precise medications that target just the prostate. So there are other ways to treat the voiding symptoms without having to be on Proscar, you know, as your sole therapy. So
okay, great. That's good to know because I'm taking also taking Flomax.
Right. Oh, that's the alpha blocker. Right. Yeah.
Okay, okay. So we've got to move on. Al, thank you very much for your call. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Okay, it's 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We will be back in 1 minute. We'll take Sarah's call.
Support comes from Premier Medical Group of the Hudson Valley, gastroenterology and urology specialists with offices in Dutchess, Ulster, and Orange counties. PremierMedicalHV.com. Anderson Center for Autism, Statsburg, New York, supporting individuals and families addressing autism spectrum disorder. AndersonCenterForAutism.org. Medical Associates of the Hudson Valley, Kingston, physicians providing health care in primary care, rheumatology, geriatrics, and more, in-office and hospital care, 845-338-7140. The Garrison in the Hudson Highlands, featuring an 18-hole golf course, restaurants, Hudson River views, and getaway and golf packages, thegarrison.com. And Dr. Richard Holub at the Neurological Associates of Albany, providing Alzheimer's research programs for over 25 years, currently conducting a research study for people with memory loss and mild to moderate Alzheimer's. 518-618-1009.
And we are back, and we are delighted to be back. Dr. Petro is here with us, and we're talking urology today. And let's, as promised, go to Sarah in New Hampshire. Okay, Sarah, you're on.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
A family member was recently diagnosed with grade 2 renal cancer with questionable lymph node involvement. And we are just really new to this diagnosis and wondering what new treatment options may be out there for him and, you know, certainly what the prognosis is with something like this. Should I take your answer off the...
No. You have to stay. That's the rules, Sarah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry to hear about your family member, but kidney cancer, you know, there's unfortunately, there's a couple of variables in that. In general, we're finding a lot of kidney cancer early, and there's not often lymph node involvement. So if that's true, I got to say that's a little more concerning.
Sure.
In general, surgery is really the best way to treat kidney cancer.
Particularly
if we can get just the lump out. A lot of times we're doing a partial kidney removal for a small.
Do they do that laparoscopically, or do they prefer to do an open incision to be able to see what else might be involved?
That depends on how old you are.
That depends on how old the surgeon is.
That's what I meant.
Yeah, right. No, a lot of that really is done laparoscopically, and some folks
right.
may use the robotic Da Vinci device
right.
just to make the surgery a little more facile. But you know, that's certainly an area that many of us will do laparoscopic approach. So if it's a smaller tumor at 4 or 5 centimeters or less, then that's usually a good one to highly consider doing a partial kidney removal. If it's in a tough location or if it's larger than that, then we really might start considering a complete kidney removal. So if it's contained and we think that it's resectable, we usually like to perform surgery. That gives people the greatest chance of long-term cure.
I think that's what he anticipates, that that's the next step.
Yeah.
He'd like to get it out sooner than later.
Yeah.
When you say long-term cure, how many... What are the numbers on kidney?
Well, I mean, of course, it's a range. So if it's a small tumor with a low grade, I mean, we talked before about prostate cancer being graded. All cancers are graded. So if it's a lower grade kidney cancer and you can get it out and have clean margins, have it be smaller, you know, that can be 90% plus of 5-year
cure. And this was a grade 2. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's had a biopsy then already, if you know
he
the grade.
He had a biopsy, yep.
So presumably if it's contained and you get a good negative margin, that's cure rates 80s, 90s%. If it is spread already, if it's metastatic, then we're looking at systemic therapy. And that used to be tough because we didn't have much in the way of chemo that works at all for kidney
right.
cancer. And actually, in truth, we really still don't have chemotherapy. We have, to split some semantics, to split words, it's targeted drug therapy. It's really targeting at some of the ways that kidney cancer grows and spreads. So it's aimed at mostly blood vessel growth. So we have a whole cluster of new agents that didn't exist 5 years ago for advanced disease.
Sarah, thank you very much for your call. And I think a lot of people will benefit
from it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's go to Howard in New Paltz. Howard, you're on. Howard.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Hey.
I just want to tell you about my own experience with dairy products, all kinds of dairy products, cheese, milk, all that stuff.
Okay.
Every time I eat it or drink it, I get a hard time urinating. My prostate swells up, and when I go away from it, it goes down and never bothers me. I just want to know if this is something that you're working on or somebody's working on it, because I think it's a little less money than surgery or drugs.
Well, that's probably true. I got to say, that's not a typical complaint that I hear from folks.
Maybe they should be asked that question if they eat a lot of dairy products, is what I'm saying.
Well, I could add that to the list of questions.
That's how diseases get cured. Somebody comes up with a layperson and says, this is what my experience is. And then somebody does a double blind, sort of
try. Yeah, question. Yeah, I mean, there certainly are a lot of known or not known, but there are a lot of dietary triggers. Caffeine is kind of notorious for increasing people's voiding symptoms. For some folks, high acid foods, spicy foods are really kind of notorious for irritating people's bladders and voiding symptoms.
Yeah.
And, maybe it is that it's the lactose, maybe the sugar that's a little more annoying for your bladder. And certainly high sugar intake may be more irritable.
I had a doctor once who told me that cow's milk is for cows.
Yeah, right. I do. You hear that thought. Generally, we're not all the same. I'm looking at Alan Chartok, and he looks a little different than I do, but we still got the same basic genetic code. The structure for us are very similar, but we're different people. So if you're more sensitive to dairy, then you should avoid dairy.
There are people who lactose intolerant.
Yeah,
that's why they made lactate.
If that's one of your triggers, then actually it's a good thing that you've discovered it.
By the way, Howard,
just to avoid.
You should know that our pediatrician back in the day said it's all right with me if you never give the kids milk.
He was ahead of his time.
He was.
Or she.
Yeah.
I have a friend who's a Vietnam veteran who keeps getting prostate problems. He drinks a quarter milk a day. I told him, I said, stop drinking milk, and he keeps getting biopsies, The doctor wants to keep giving him biopsies, which costs money. So I said, just give up the milk for a couple of weeks and see what happens,
Well, but you don't know that the doctor's telling him to drink it just so he can do the biopsies, do you?
It's not worth it. A little cynical,
that's all.
It's just not worth it for that.
Howard, thanks for the great call. Appreciate it.
It's good talking to you.
Right. Let's go to Dave in New Paltz. Okay, Dave in New Paltz, you're on.
Hi, this is Dave. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Calling about my mom. She went into the hospital about a month ago with sepsis. They found a kidney stone after finding a UTI.
Right.
And they found another stone in the middle of the kidney and one kind of like they ended up putting a stent in to drain the kidney.
Right.
And now the urologist has given us two options for a course of action, either lithotripsy surgery or keep the stent in and change the stent periodically, like 3 to 4 months apart, to avoid surgery. And we're a little concerned. She's 91 years old. She's got some dementia and all. She can't really make her own decision. My sister and I are concerned about her going under. And my question is, what kind of we haven't had a chance to talk to the anesthesiologist yet. Do they have to put somebody completely under and tube their throat and everything when you do that kind of procedure for someone in that age group?
Yeah, so those are great questions. But, there's really several variables that'll affect that answer. So depends on how big the stone is, where the stone is. I'm assuming if she got a stent, it's probably, I think you're implying that it was trying to make a run for it from the kidney down to the bladder, and it got stuck in the ureter.
Right.
So if it's a ureteral stone, you know, that's not a very complicated surgery to get that out. I mean, as long as it's not some massive stone. But typically we'll have the patient get some anesthesia, which can either be general with a breathing tube or even a kind of a back-of-the-throat breathing tube, or sometimes we can do it under a spinal anesthetic. And then we look inside the bladder, we take the stent out, we pass a little wire for safety, and we travel next to that wire, get up there with the telescope, and quite commonly would use a laser to break that down to small sand and gravel, grit, either flush those pieces out or basket those pieces out. And that's not, you know, from our perspective, it's not a particularly complex operation.
No, is that the same thing as lithotripsy?
So lithotripsy just means breaking up a stone.
Right.
And you can break up a stone using shockwave or soundwave right. lithotripsy. You can break it up using laser lithotripsy. You use pneumatic or ultrasonic lithotripsy. So lithotripsy is a little bit vague.
And Dave mentioned UTI. What's that?
Urinary tract infection.
Okay.
Yeah. So depending on the location of the stone, you know, it really would not be usually a particularly complex surgery to get that stone out. And then you'd avoid having to change your stent every several months.
Right. There's one stone in the middle of the kidney that he's just going to leave alone. The other stone is right near where the stent is. That's the one he wants to remove.
Yeah.
But you think overall it's better to remove the stone than deal with the stent changing or the risk of infection with the stent?
Yeah, I think as a general rule, yes. But, you know, what her tolerance for anesthesia and what her general health is will dictate whether that's really safe for her specifically. But in general, sure, I'd like to get the stone out if we could.
Dave from New Paltz, thank you for calling. Appreciate
it. All right.
Yeah.
Have a good one.
Yeah, you too. Let's go to Rachel in Hyde Park, 1-800-348-2551. Rachel.
Hi, Dr. Pietro. I think I just saw you a few days ago.
Uh-oh.
This is your patient who's recovering.
I recognize your voice.
Well, I recognize yours, too, and it was really comforting to hear it as I'm trying to recover here. I actually did have a question.
Uh-oh. Go ahead.
Well, it's about a fibroid that I just recently found that I have in my uterus, and it's rather large, and I was wondering if that could be obstructing urine flow in a sort of a general sense over the years.
So fibroids, you know, they can be really small. They can get quite large.
Why don't you define what they are?
Oh, first. Fibroids. So a fibroid is a smooth muscle tumor. It's usually benign of the uterus.
Right.
And they're really common. Of course, women only because they have the uterus.
And they can get pretty big.
And they can get pretty large.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. And the guy said, this is a large fibroid, which I took to mean that it was a large fibroid.
Yeah. So, Rachel, I of course I know who you are, but I don't remember the size of your fibroid. But so if they're really large, you know, it might push on the ureters. Those are the little tubes that come from the kidney down to the bladder. I've seen that a few times where a fibroid's big enough to actually pinch or just get so space occupying that it pushes the ureters as they come down. That's not normal. That's not typical. There is a nuclear medicine test you can look at to see how well the kidneys drain, how well they get the urine in and get the urine out. So a nuclear test would see whether that fibroid is actually causing any obstruction, it's like stepping on a hose and causing
sort of like
the urine.
A dye or something.
Right.
Like
that. Is that different than the renal scan that I had?
That would be a renal LASIK scan, right?
Okay. Yeah, that's what I had before my surgery with you to just make sure they were both working.
Yeah. So, you know, of course you catch me without my chart opened. We focused on your kidney tumor today.
I'm telling you, it's such a small world. And I'm doing really well. Yesterday was an amazing day for me, although I did overdo it.
Uh-oh.
I ended up feeling dizzy and kind of went back to get checked out at the emergency room, but everything checked out great. So,
well, listen, just because we did it laparoscopically doesn't mean you got to take the time to recover.
Yeah. I know, I get a little bit excited, but okay. I did want to thank you. I think you did an amazing job, the whole team.
Oh, thanks.
And, yeah, surgery wasn't awful.
Good.
Rachel, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Alan. Take care, guys.
Bye.
Okay,
1-800-348-2551. Just one free phone, but it could be yours. Let's go to Martin in New Paltz. Okay, Martin, you're on.
Thank you so much. I had been diagnosed with a prostate cancer with a Gleason score of 7.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, my testosterone level was diagnosed at 126. At that point in my life, I was 67 years old, or 66 years old. I was scheduled for surgery on the prostate removal in New York, and then it fell apart, the operation, so it didn't proceed. I then, 2 years later, just last autumn, went to the Cleveland Clinic. They did a biopsy of 20 spots and found, found no cancer. So I called the urologist. I said, well, is my Gleason score? He said, Mr. Schotta, I can't tell you because there's no indication of you having cancer.
Sure.
In the meantime, my testosterone level increased to approximately 400 and change. I don't have the exact number.
Now, I take it, doctor. Wait, one second, Martin. I take it, doctor.
Yes.
400 is very high, right?
400 for testosterone?
Yes.
No, that's fairly normal range.
Okay.
No, normal.
Yeah.
But it went from this totally abnormal low one.
Right.
To at the same time, my cancer is in remission or disappeared. I can't get a clear handle on that. What happened to the cancer if they can't detect it on the taking 20 samples?
Yeah. So a couple.
Does cancer go away?
Well, so a couple of possibilities. So one, you know, there probably are cancers that come and go that we don't even recognize, that your body, your own immune system is always on the alert for something abnormal. So in theory, you could clear some small volume of prostate cancer. Now, it looks like we certainly see that with other tumors. You hear about it in breast, that a small lesion.
But is it unusual with the prostate for that to occur?
I don't think anyone's really studied that particularly well. So, I mean, it is possible that you had such a tiny little focus that your body cleared it. What is probably much more likely is that your the volume of prostate cancer was low in the first place, and although 20 samples seems like a knot, they didn't actually take out your entire prostate gland with the biopsy needles. They just took a bunch of samples. And
the first one was a 12 sample,
right? And
which detected the cancer.
Yeah, but no, if there was one fraction of one core, it may just be that no one found the exact same spot. So it's a low-volume prostate cancer, you may not be able to find it again. It's the proverbial needle in the haystack. It's in there, but it's really such a small volume, you can't find the exact same place.
You hit the bullseye again.
Right, exactly.
What about the possibility of lab error in the analysis?
That is possible, too. So
I had the first test confirmed by a totally different pathologist
and
a different laboratory.
And that's good, and that's smart. It's a smart thing to get second opinions at times. Yeah. But
on that particular item.
You know, I think I have to look at the reports and all that, but as a quick surface, the biggest, most likely answer is that you have such a small volume of prostate cancer that they just couldn't find it again, which actually is great news for you.
Well, it's certainly not growing, we would assume.
Right.
And what would you say about the low testosterone? At that point, I was diagnosed as hypogonadism.
Yeah, right. So as a quick answer on that is that testosterone goes up and down, and any other intercurrent or any other sort of illness can make it go down. You can get a viral infection and get a bad flu, and your testosterone goes down. So usually, so if I have a patient comes in with a single low testosterone, I'm going to double check it before we commit them to a lifetime replacement.
Hey, Martin.
Oh, I had a number, Martin.
Where you're done. You're definitely done. We have to take
I'm fried. I am over the line.
You are.
Okay.
We have to take a break. So long.
Thank you,
bye.
Guys. Yeah. And wish you luck.
1-800-348-2551. We take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from St. Francis Hospital and Health Centers Poughkeepsie, celebrating 100 years serving the healthcare needs of the community, including the Rettle Cancer Care Center, emergency and trauma care, and advanced robotic surgery, sfhospital.org. Adelphi University Hudson Valley Center's Graduate Social Work Program and Graduate and Undergraduate Nursing Programs, hosting an open house Saturday, October 5th, 11 a.m., St. Francis Hospital Medical Arts Pavilion, hudson-valley.adelphi.edu. Express Pediatrics Highland, walk-in urgent care for children, specializing in trauma care including fractures, rashes, wounds, asthma, tick bites, sports injuries, and more, expresspediatrics.com. Ward's Nursery and Garden Center, Great Barrington, for long-blooming perennials, hardy mums, native ornamental grasses, shade trees, blueberries, garden supplies, and garden advice. WardsNursery.com. And Middletown Medical, with a walk-in urgent care center in Middletown, with pediatricians available until 9 p.m. weeknights, minimal wait times, evening and weekend hours. MiddletownMedical.com.
We are back. We are back with a wonderful doctor, Dr. Petro, and he is specializes in general urology, including the treatment of kidney stones, surgical kidney cancer management, BPH, and PSA screening. Dr. Petro, an old hand now. This is his second time back here, and we are delighted to have him. Let's go to Barbara in White Lake, New York. Okay, Barbara, you're on.
Thank you for being there. Two-prong attack here. I'm a recovering stroke victim, and my bladder has control sometimes and doesn't have control sometimes. I had a hemorrhagic stroke. It took out the left side of my body, just as if you had sliced me right down the middle.
Wow.
And, you know, I have OT and PT, and I've come back. I bicycle, I exercise, and all that stuff, so I'm well on the road to recovery. But the bladder seems to be not responding as well, and it's a come-and-go thing. Is there any hope that it will correct itself?
Well, so the bladder, like any other organ, it has neurologic control. And normally our kidneys make urine. The urine comes down to the bladder, it fills, and it starts sending you little signals that it's getting full, and your brain says, you know, now or not now. And that requires upper brain control, cortical control, as you will. And there's a little regulator is in feedback loops. So with the stroke, unfortunately, some that neurologic control, some of those feedback loops have been interrupted. Now, some of that you may be able to retrain it over time. If there's any recovery of some of the feedback loops and some of the cortical control, you may get better bladder control with time. Depending on the type of symptoms, with overactivity or urgency, there are even some medications that could be used to try to slow down some of the overactivity. But
I would guess that you might consider it overactivity. What it is, the brain hears that you have to go to the bathroom, and you go there, but sometimes you're just standing up, and there it is, you know?
Right.
You don't have the time.
No, and so the timing, the urgency, and the frequency can be oftentimes slowed. And there's a couple of different categories of meds that could be tried. Some of them have some side effects of dry mouth and constipation. There's a brand-new medication. Generally a little pricier because it's brand new, but there are actually some reasonable treatment options to try to slow down overactive bladder.
Okay. The other, and part two about bladder, for 6 years I was on the drug Actos. I see on the TV Actos causes bladder cancer. What would be symptoms of bladder cancer?
Well, the Actos and bladder cancer connection, there is some truth to that. There's a lot of worrying to that as right now as well. But oftentimes there's not a lot of symptoms of bladder cancer. One of the greatest signs would be blood in the urine, particularly if you can visually see macroscopic or gross hematuria, blood you can see when you urinate. That's obviously a concerning sign. But sometimes with increasing frequency, urgency, or even burning, those are sometimes some sneaky signs or symptoms. But certainly your physician should be able to take a look at a urinalysis and look for any blood. Microscopic blood would probably prompt some telescope and evaluation.
So that's
protein. So there's no, like, blood test for it, like...
Urine test.
Or anything.
A urinalysis, a simple urine study.
Okay.
Hey, Barbara,
thanks
for the call.
Much.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Let us go to Edward in East. Edward in East Hampton. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Good, good. I hear somebody else talking. Go ahead.
Okay. My question is: I have an enlarged prostate, and I take Prestor and Flomax, and my urologist said to try to stop taking the Flomax, which I did, and if I had difficulty to go back on it, which I had to do.
Yeah.
Now, my question is, just recently, I seem to have a, well, I guess you could call it dribbling. You know, after I urinate, I know I have to urinate and everything.
Right.
And I'm done, there's a slight amount of, you know, urine that's, would that be because of the prostate, or is that something I should check with my urologist again about?
No, that's a fairly common symptom of the prostate and voiding stuff. So, you know, your bladder squeezes, and when you're young, you got a great strength of stream. You know, the old joke about bark on the tree and all that sort of stuff. So you got a better force of stream when you're a young man. And as you age, that force gets weaker and weaker, and so it just doesn't clear the pipe in one good push. And so that urine you're describing, the post-void dribbling, is urine that's get left behind in the urethra because it didn't just get pushed out forcefully.
You know, when I go to the urologist, I can't remember. It's a flow test that they...
Yeah, exactly.
And they always say, well, you have a good, you know, your stream, you know, your stay is good. It's actually really good.
Yeah.
But doctor, let me ask the doctor a question, if I may, Edward. Aren't there techniques that somebody like Edward could use to clear out the extra urine within the pipe?
Well, so... yeah, that's a loaded question. But
I happen to know the answer.
I think you do. Right. So, you know, some folks may actually, what Alan's alluded to, some folks may actually sort of reach behind the scrotum and sort of just like squeegee the pipe.
Right.
You know, just basically try to push any leftover urine in the urethra and basically push it from the back of the urethra out to the front. And like a squeegee, just get that urine out before you walk away. And as best you can, as you end of your void, try to really relax. Rather than push the urine out, you want to relax and let that last little bit come out. And then a squeegee technique is not a bad idea.
Guys have written poetry. This is such a...
Another thing I found is if I stand, it happens more than if I, you know, if I have to urinate, I sit down.
Yeah.
And it doesn't be... is bad if I sit down as when I stand. So is that probably because when I stand I have a tendency to, as you say, force?
Yeah, you might. Boy, it's kind of funny because just the other day some guy said he's better when he stands than when he sits.
Sure.
And there's definitely just some dynamics, some physics at play. So you find a comfortable position that gets you more empty, I'd stick with it.
Now, I happen to know a doctor that when you were entering medical school, they made you take courses in physics. Does that kind of thing help you out in a case like this?
No, that's too far removed.
Edward, thanks for a great call. I know a lot of people have the same problem.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, bye. 1-800-348-2551. Hey, there are three free phones. Now's the time. Let's go to Nick in Stockbridge. Nick. Hey, Nick. Nick going, oh, no, well, I see what the problem is. Okay. I see. See, yeah, Nick, okay. It was my fault. We got to get the engineering department down here. Phone number 4 has a loose cap on it. So it's sort of like what we were just hearing about the urologist, but we have to, about, you know, having excess stuff. But we have to get the staff down here to fix that.
So are we okay?
Yeah, now we're okay, right.
Okay. After having a high PSA and a Gleason that called for immediate treatment, I suggested that some other tests be done. It turned out that I also had, in addition to prostate cancer, kidney cancer. Had a partial kidney removal, which eventually went very well.
Good.
Then I had radiation and hormonal treatments, combination with chemotherapy. I've been finished with treatment for about 7 or 8 months. My testosterone level has gone back up again, but there's almost no semen. Is that a common problem? I wasn't told about that. And will that return?
So your prostate's still there, which just as a quick aside, you know, if we remove the prostate and the seminal vesicles for a surgical treatment of prostate cancer, there's not going to be any semen because the ejaculatory machinery is gone.
I understand.
So for you, you had radiation.
Right, and hormones.
Yeah,
right.
Sure. So that's going to cause damage to the gland as well. You know, the idea is you're trying to kill those cancer cells with the radiation. And so it's going to cause the gland to shrivel. It's going to atrophy. Some of the ducts, certainly within the gland itself, are going to get dry.
Which gland are we talking about now?
Prostate.
Prostate. Okay.
Yeah. So losing semen, losing ejaculation, and, you know, unfortunately losing some erectile function is all a potential side effect of radiation therapy.
Now,
is that permanent?
Likely.
And anything I can do to reverse it? Not likely. Okay.
Wait. 1 second. I want to ask a question. Doctor, do you think, because almost every urologist we ever have, we always ask their preferences in terms of radiation versus surgery. Do you have any advice on this?
No, not as a rule of thumb. Mm-hmm. You know, those are the two competing main treatment choices, right? Surgery versus radiation. And there is a better fit, you know. So the older gentleman who you do want to treat, but you're worried about surgery, may be better suited for radiation. The younger, the 52-year-old guy who's got decades ahead of him, there is a preference for surgery in that gentleman. So there are some obvious scenarios where you really may lean to one treatment versus another.
But let me just get something straight. In surgery, you can always do the radiation later, right? But in radiation, you can't do the surgery later.
It's a very difficult operation to come back later and take out the prostate mm-hmm. once you've had radiation.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, listen, some of it has to come down to the patient preference. There's side effects to these treatments. And I think a really meaningful and a useful conversation is going through those side effects. And if you think that the treatment is going to be fairly equivocal, then it really should be guided by the patient's preference of what he wants to put up with.
I see. Okay. Hey, Nick, thank you
very much. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye.
For calling. Okay. Now we're down to the last phone call. So if you want to get on with our wonderful surgeon right now, 1-800-348-2551 for Dr. Petro. Okay, let's go to George in Great Barrington. Okay, George, how you doing?
Yes, hello. Thank you. Question is, I have an enlarged testicle, and I understand that there's a procedure to correct it. And I wondered, first of all, what caused it, and how involved the procedure is, whether it's something they can do in a short hospital visit.
Sure. So. I would suspect that what you're describing is an enlarged fluid around the testicle.
Yes, that's right.
So that's called a hydrocele. There can be something called a spermatocele, which also sits in the scrotum. But basically, both of those are fluid collections that are abnormal and have built up. A spermatocele actually is fluid that's built up in probably clogged ducts within the epididymis. And the epididymis is that little gland that sits piggyback behind the testicle. So some of those glands get clogged up, little ducts get clogged up, and next thing you know, you got fluid in there. Uh-huh. And a hydrocele is an abnormal collection of fluid around the testicle. There's normally a little bit of a physiologic hydrocele. There's a little bit of fluid around the testicle. But if perhaps there's some damage to the lymphatics, the lymph drainage out of the spermatic cord, then we sometimes see that a hydrocele forms. And it's not always a great understanding as to why that happens for any individual. But a hydrocele doesn't have to be treated. Now, a gentleman can certainly elect to have that removed if it really becomes a bother. And they can get pretty large. And, you know, frankly, they can get kind of in the way. You sit down, you stand up, you ride a bicycle. This thing's always there kind of seeming to get in your way when you're trying to get comfortable.
Yep.
So a surgery for that is really the most effective. And what tends to happen is we it's a day surgery. You get out of the hospital the same day. You get some anesthesia. We make an incision in the scrotum. You sort of deliver the testicle with that fluid around it, and you drain the fluid. But if you just took the fluid out, it's going to refill. So you have to alter the cavity. So we take that little sac around it, and you kind of literally turn it inside out. It's like turning your sock inside out. And then you stitch it to itself so it can't reclose. So you take the fluid out, you reduce the sac, you flip it inside out so it can't reseal its own edges. And then things go back into the scrotum, we sew it up. That's like a half an hour operation, 40 minutes. It's usually the same day. And the biggest catch is you got to take it easy for a week or two afterwards so you don't get all swollen. You just got to make sure you take some time to recover.
Well, thank you very much.
George, thank you for calling. Appreciate it.
Bye.
Yep. Okay. Oops, whoa, I messed up. I don't know what I did. Okay. now I think I somebody well I don't. Okay, but anyway, let's go to Jeff in Pittsfield. Jeff, go.
Hi, I was just calling to just point out I had robotic surgery to have my prostate removed in 2011. Okay. But after when I found out that I had it, I took my time and researched it, talked to a lot of different doctors, found out the best course of action. There was a possibility I could get the radiation, settled on a robotic because of my age.
Okay.
To have the radical prostatectomy, and I had great results. So although at first, you know, it's pretty scary to hear that you have cancer of any kind, the results can be positive, and I've had great results. Everything's come back to normal function.
Good.
And I just wanted to point that out, that it's not just, you know, it's not all just gloom and doom over this.
No, indeed.
It can work out well.
No, I think, you know, if we didn't think that we could have good results and we didn't have patients with good results, we wouldn't offer it. I mean, I've never met a surgeon who's not an optimist, but we have to be realistic, too, and let people know what can happen, what the side effects are.
But I got to tell you, I got a lot of friends who had prostate cancer years and years ago and who are doing very well.
Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah, I think I'm glad you did well. I mean, the robot is a tool. And you got to go to hands who know how to use the tool well. It's just still a set of instruments.
Hmm. It was also very important to follow my doctor's orders after the surgery, to do everything that I was told, because that's what it was hard to do sometimes, because you want to get back into things and do things the way you used to, but you got to take it slow and do the exercises that helps you get back to normal.
No, it certainly helps. It's supposed to be team effort. So we give you some advice for what we think takes for you to recover well, and it's glad to hear that people, you know, follow that.
Hey, Jeff, got to let you go. Thank you very much.
Thanks for taking my...
Let's go to Hope in Rock Hill. Hope, go. We're running out of time here.
Hi. To give me my medical history, I have RSV and problems with muscle spasms in my ear. I had a DNC for heavy menstrual flow, and shortly after that, I developed a problem where I would feel like I have to go to the bathroom, but nothing would happen. So they diagnosed me with interstitial cystitis, and even with a very restricted diet, and I went through several different kinds of medication, which is incredibly costly, I'm really not sure about getting results, and they tell me that the lining on the bladder is too thin, and that's why it's being irritated. Can you tell me if there's any other things I should be doing, or is this going to be permanent? I don't get an answer whether that this could ever be cured or not.
Yeah, so that's a big old can of worms. So interstitial cystitis, real quick, that's a poorly understood, oftentimes chronic inflammation of the bladder. We really don't know why it happens. I mean, it's important you make sure it's not a few other things. You want to make sure it's not a certain type of bladder cancer. You want to make sure it's not infections. But if we're left with IC, with this interstitial cystitis, it can be hard to treat. So you're doing a lot of great things. You know, you're paying attention to fluid and diet. You're avoiding some of the dietary triggers. There are some medications that can help, but it's usually trial and error. You might try... there's medications called Elavil, there's Elmeron, there's a bladder wash agent we can use. Sometimes we use some antihistamine agents. So there are some medications that can be used in addition to physical therapy, yoga, stress relief, and dietary triggers. But frankly, those are kind of trial and error to find a medication in addition to those things that might be best for you.
Well, thank you.
I did try physical
Hope,
therapy.
Hope, I have to cut you off only because we're out of time.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Okay, so we are out of time, as I said. Want to thank everyone. 1-800-323-9262, Gerard in Woodstock and Adrian in New Paltz. We'll try to get you the next time. Thanks, everybody, for joining us on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Zach Beloy. Your calls were answered by Colleen O'Connell. She's wonderful. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Alan Shartok. On tomorrow's program, it's an open forum, and guess what we're talking about? We're talking about Syria. So what you do now is stay tuned now for a news update.